Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, American, European and RCVS specialist in small animal surgery, Pilar Lafuente. Thank you, Pilar. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Emer. Thank you, everyone, for being here today for this webinar. Today we are going to talk on injuries in sporting dogs. So I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with these canine competitions and working dogs, but in general, in the past few years, there's been an exponential increase in the amount of this type of competitions, especially agility and obedience, in the UK and also in the world, like in North America. These canine patients that we are gonna focus on today, they can be involved in sports and pleasure activities like agility, as I was saying. There's been a boom recently, so we see more and more of these competitions and actually more and more of these patients in our clinic. Other of these competitions are obedience, flyball, we have gun dogs, tracking dogs. There are many of these competitions, canicross for example. But we are also going to focus on some of the injuries that working dogs can have. Working dogs, we are including police dogs, rescue dogs, assistants, etc. So these patients, obviously, they do a fair amount of competitions per year, and then they do quite intense training to keep a level of fitness that is actually higher than in a normal pet. So these animals can have a risk of injuries, and specifically some injuries depending on the activity that they perform. And when we diagnose that condition and we treat them, we obviously want to return these patients to a normal function, but not only a normal function like we will do in a pet. We need to go back to the same level of fitness that they had before the injury. So that's more challenging than in a pet. So we want to return these patients to competition or working activities. Having said that, we are going to focus on these competition dogs, but there are also pets that are not involved in competition, official competitions or work, but they are very active dogs, and they run with their owners, or they do quite a lot of activities, trekking or activities with children. So they are also susceptible to have injuries, orthopedic injuries. So there's been a couple of studies in the past, and they've seen that 33% of agility dogs will have sport-related injuries. The majority of these injuries are tendon in nature or ligament, especially in the shoulder. The shoulder is a common cause of forelimb lameness. So here, for example, you have among all the breeds, the most common injuries in agility dogs, and we can see that the majority have shoulder issues. We are going to focus quite a lot on shoulder conditions that they may have. They can have also back problems, especially lumbosacral disease, and also stifles. And then they can have, obviously, other orthopedic conditions. In agility dogs, for example, one of the obstacles, the A-frame, is kind of like a triangle, and that can predispose dogs to have osteoarthritis in the phalanges. So they can have also a lameness and decreased performance due to this. So these patients, they can have clinical signs that can be quite obvious, like they can have fractures as any other active dogs, they can have a proper lameness, but the clients, they keep an eye on these dogs, on these competition dogs quite closely, so they can actually notice any changes much sooner than any other client could do. So these are the common signs that we can see in these athlete dogs. For example, in agility, we may see dogs that are knocking bars, jumping, or they are refusing to jump, as you can see here in this photo. They can have a decreased speed, and or for example, in an obstacle, the whips, we will see a video a little bit later, they can do a two-footing instead of one-footing. Or for example, flyball, we will see also a video. So if you are not familiar with this competition, you can see, we will see a video. They can have increased competition times, and obviously, as I was saying, they can always develop a lameness. As I was saying, these owners keep a very close eye on these dogs, so sometimes the lameness is very subtle. It's quite difficult to notice. So we are going to start with forelimb injuries. It's quite difficult to compact all the injuries that these sporting dogs may have in an hour, so I'll do my best. Forelimb injuries, as I was saying, the shoulder is a common place to be injured for these patients, so we are going to focus quite a lot. We'll start with the supraspinatus tendon. Here you can see a photo of the shoulder. We have the supraspinatus muscle, which inserts into the greater tubercle of the humerus. We also have the biceps, and we'll talk about this, and the medial glenohumeral ligament. So in general, the shoulder actually, or sometimes we think of these pathologies as completely isolated conditions, but actually in the shoulder, we need to think of the shoulder as a whole. And these three conditions, the supraspinatus tendinopathy, bicipital tenosynovitis or tendinopathy, and medial shoulder instability, they can actually appear simultaneously. So they are a little bit related one to the other, but I'm going to explain each separately. So the supraspinatus is a shoulder extensor, and actually we are diagnosing more and more this tendinopathy, probably because the diagnostic techniques are improving in the past few years. We have seen that there is an area of low vascularity close to the insertion of this tendon, so this area predisposes this tendon to become hypoxic and then undergo degenerative processes and mineralization of the tendon. So the supraspinatus tendinopathy can be a mineralized tendinopathy with the formation of mineralized foci inside of the tendon, but it can also be a non-mineralized tendinopathy. And usually this is a condition related to overuse and repetitive trauma to the tendon. So if we see a video, here you have a video of a flyball. In this competition, dogs need to jump over some hurdles and then hit a pad, and then a ball will come out and they need to take it. And if you can think of the speed that these dogs reach, is quite high, and they hit really hard on this pad. So when they hit, and you will see this last dog in slow motion, when they hit, the shoulder is in flexion slightly, so that the tendon of the supraspinatus is elongated, and this repetitive trauma on an elongated or a lengthened tendon is one of the potential causes for supraspinatus tendinopathy. So it has been reported that the supraspinatus tendinopathy is presented in 1/3 of working and athlete dogs, especially Labradors, Border Collies, and German Shepherd dogs. Border Collie is one of the most common breeds, including these competitions. It can be, and the majority of the times, is a unilateral problem, but it may also be a bilateral condition. We need to have in mind that sometimes we take radiographs of the shoulder and we may see mineralization of the supraspinatus. We just need to have in mind that it can be an incidental finding. So we may find mineralization of the supraspinatus that is not causing any problem to the dog. So that's why our physical and orthopedic examination is going to be very, very important, to see if we can localize the source of the pain, the source of the lameness, if it's the shoulder. And that's what's making this condition a little bit more challenging. And as I was saying before, these dogs with supraspinatus tendinopathy, more than 90% of those also suffered soft tissue pathologies in the shoulder. As I was saying, they can also suffer bicipital tendinopathy or medial shoulder instability. So we need to see the shoulder as a whole. So what are we going to find in dogs with supraspinatus tendinopathy? So the lameness is variable. We have dogs with very mild and subtle lameness and decreased performance. And opposite to that, we may have dogs with more marked lameness, which is usually a weight-bearing lameness. Usually this is a chronic condition, as I was saying, is due to overuse or repetitive trauma. And in up to 75% of dogs suffering supraspinatus tendinopathy, they can be non-responsive to previous treatment. This previous treatment is usually exercise restriction, NSAIDs, and the lameness may improve, but as soon as you resume activity, they start being lame again. When we do our orthopedic examination, in not all dogs may show some type of pain or discomfort when we palpate directly over the supraspinatus tendon. So if we flex the shoulder and we apply pressure over the greater tubercle of the humerus where the tendon inserts, they can have a little bit of a spasm or be uncomfortable. We have other ways of evaluating these dogs. We can do an objective gait evaluation with force plates or pressure mats. So here, for example, we have an example of what we will find with a pressure mat. This is what I use in the clinic. And it gives you quite a lot of information of step length, stride length, stance time, etc. But also it gives you the pressure percentage. So it's usually 30-30 in the forelimbs and 20-20 in the hind limbs, which in a ratio it will be around 100% in each leg. And when we see that it's decreased, it's because there's something going on in that leg. It doesn't tell you it's the shoulder, but at least it can help when these animals have a subtle lameness. So we have localized, hopefully, that the problem is in the shoulder. The dog may show muscle atrophy, pain in the shoulder. We may take radiographs. In the radiographs, we may be able to see mineralization in the area of the supraspinatus tendon. But as I was saying, sometimes there's no mineralization. I routinely do a CT, because in the CT I can see not only if there is mineralization, but I can also see if there is enlargement of the tendon or if there is osteoarthritis. I can see much better than with the radiographs. And then to see the structure of the soft tissue structures in the shoulder, we can do ultrasound or MRI. The ultrasound, it depends on the experience of the person doing the ultrasound, but you can actually see changes in the supraspinatus tendon. So here, for example, on the right, we have a normal supraspinatus. This is the greater tubercle with the bicipital groove here and the biceps. This is a transverse cut. And we have the supraspinatus tendon, which is normal in size. Here on the left, we have an abnormal ultrasound. We can see that the supraspinatus is enlarged. And sometimes we can see even hypoechoic foci in the supraspinatus. And the biceps is being squeezed by the enlarged supraspinatus. In the MRI, we can see also changes similar to these. We can see signs of edema in the supraspinatus tendon. As you can see here, we can see that the biceps is being squeezed in the bicipital groove, and there's some flattening of the tendon. So how do we treat it? Usually acute supraspinatus tendinopathy is very uncommon. So usually they will present in a subacute or chronic phase. Theoretically, because the supraspinatus tendon is associated with bicipital tendinopathy and medial shoulder instability, I usually recommend to do arthroscopy of the shoulder to evaluate these structures. Because it's a chronic problem, the NSAIDs or anti-inflammatories is contraindicated. We actually want to restart the inflammatory process and so that there's healing of the degeneration of the tendon. So mainly the treatment of the supraspinatus is physiotherapy, so exercise restriction, rehabilitation with different types of massage and cross-friction massage and modalities. It's been reported the use of therapeutic ultrasound for supraspinatus tendinopathy or shockwave therapy has shown pretty good results in general in dogs with shoulder pathologies, not only supraspinatus tendinopathy, but also medial shoulder instability and bicipital tendinopathy. Also, CANAP has done a couple of studies on supraspinatus tendinopathy, and he has seen pretty good results with regenerative medicine, with the injection of stem cell therapy and platelet-rich plasma together. He's seen a recovery of more than 90%. Sometimes they perform a second dose inside of the tendon, and they saw a full return of these dogs to competition. Other authors, they haven't seen improvement after one single injection of the PRP, platelet-rich plasma, but as I was saying, CANAP has seen a better results when the stem cell therapy and the platelet-rich plasma is combined. So when these patients don't respond to conservative treatment, surgery can be performed. I have more experience with surgical treatment of supraspinatus tendinopathy. Usually you need to do a shoulder arthroscopy to evaluate the medial structures of the shoulder and also the biceps, because the biceps is commonly affected, and if it's quite injured, it needs to be cut. And then I will do a craniomedial approach to the supraspinatus tendon, and I will remove part of the tendon, and I will do some longitudinal incisions in the tendon to remove the calcified foci if there is if it is a mineralized supraspinatus tendinopathy. And I've seen an outcome in around 60% of patients. We just need to have in mind that, as I was saying, this condition may be associated with bicipital tenosynovitis or medial shoulder instability, and also it's not uncommon that these dogs also have elbow dysplasia, so sometimes we need to do arthroscopy of both the shoulder and the elbow. So quite challenging. Then if we continue with the shoulder, we have biceps tendinopathy. The clinical signs are very similar to supraspinatus tendinopathy. It's usually a chronic lameness that doesn't respond to rest and NSAIDs, and is due to repetitive trauma. Sometimes they can also develop a rupture, partial or complete rupture of the bicipital tendon. So when we do our orthopedic examination, these dogs may be painful when we do the bicep stretch. In that case, we need to flex the shoulder and extend the elbow. That will put pressure or that will put tension on the biceps. And then if we press over the bicipital groove, we are applying pressure directly over the biceps, and they may show pain. In some occasions, they can develop a rupture of the biceps, as you can see in this dog. So this is the right side, this is the left side. I don't know if you notice a difference. In the left side, we can see when we flex the shoulder and extend the elbow, we can still see a little bit of an angle in the elbow, while on the right side, the elbow is completely extended. In this case, this dog had almost a complete rupture of the biceps, and that's why we can extend the elbow this much. If the dog is painful and lame, is probably because there are still a few fibers of the biceps that are still attached enough to cause lameness. So if we localize the problem to the shoulder, as I was saying, you can do radiography. You need a special views like the skyline. In those cases, you can see osteophytes around the bicipital groove. You can also see mineralization inside of the bicipital groove. I usually do a CT, so I can see the osteoarthritis much better. And actually, with the CT, you can also see enlargement of the biceps. And as I was saying before, you can also do an ultrasound and evaluate the biceps if there's any impingement, if there is supraspinatus tendinopathy at the same time, or you can evaluate the pattern of the fibers of the biceps, see if there's any rupture, see if there is enlargement of the biceps also from edema. You can also do an MRI. So the treatment, again, most commonly is a chronic condition, but if you are in front of an acute condition, which is not very common, you can treat it with exercise restriction. Sometimes you can inject steroids in the joint if it's supraspinatus bicipital tenosynovitis, so inflammation around the tendon rather than a proper tendinopathy. But the most common presentation is a chronic condition. So again, very similar to supraspinatus tendinopathy, we are trying to restart the inflammatory process so we can allow healing of the tendon. So usually NSAIDs and in general anti-inflammatories are not recommended. The treatment involves exercise restriction and rehabilitation with, you know, cross-friction massage modalities like therapeutic ultrasound, laser, and if we can see core lesions in the ultrasound of the tendon, we can inject platelet-rich plasma and stem cells inside of the tendon. If this treatment is not, if they don't respond to this treatment, then we can perform arthroscopy and then tenotomy of the tendon if it's markedly affected. We can do this tenotomy arthroscopically. We don't need to open, and actually there's no need to perform tenodesis or reattachment of the tendon into the humerus. Usually the tendon will drop along the bicipital groove and will reattach in the proximal humerus with time. Usually if there's only bicipital tendinopathy, usually the prognosis is pretty good. But as I was saying, sometimes it can appear with other conditions in the shoulder, and then the prognosis is a little bit more variable. And then the third condition in the shoulder is medial shoulder instability. Again, the presentation is very similar with a chronic chronic lameness, usually due to repetitive trauma or overuse. The majority of the times is unilateral, although it can also be presented bilaterally, and is an injury to the supportive structures of the medial shoulder, especially the subscapular muscle and the medial glenohumeral ligament. We'll see some images. So this is how it should look. This is the glenoid cavity, this is the humeral head, this is the cranial arm of the medial glenohumeral ligament, which is normal, and this is the subscapularis muscle, which is normal. We'll see how it looks when they are affected. So if we play this video, this is one of the obstacles in agility that actually put more tension in the medial supportive structures of the shoulder. So these are the WIPs. And the first dog, you can see that dogs are just putting one leg in each side. So there's quite a lot of abduction of the shoulder. I mean, you can imagine how much force is applying on these structures. The second dog, you can see that he's putting both legs in both sides. This is probably one of the first signs that we can see in dogs with medial shoulder instability. It's the abduction is painful, so instead of putting just one foot in each side, they are putting both because they are trying to avoid this abduction of the shoulder. So again, clinical signs is usually an intermittent lameness, chronic lameness that doesn't usually respond to NSAIDs or recur once you return to normal activities. We can find signs of chronic lameness like muscle atrophy, some type of discomfort in the shoulder. And one of the most important tests that we can do to evaluate medial shoulder instability is the abduction angle. In a normal, so usually it's done with the dog under sedation, and we are just measuring the angle of abduction of the shoulder. Normal is around 30 degrees. When it's greater than 50, is consistent with the medial shoulder instability. If we take radiographs, we may see some osteoarthritis due to the chronicity. We could do an MRI and we could see some soft tissue injuries, but usually the affected structures are pretty small. So the gold standard to diagnosing medial shoulder instability is arthroscopy. So this is the image that I showed you before. This is an arthroscopy of a normal shoulder with a normal structure. This is the medial glenohumeral ligament. This is the subscapularis. And this is a dog with medial shoulder instability. Again, this is the glenoid cavity. This is the humeral head. Here at the back, we can see the subscapularis tendon. And this is the cranial arm of the medial glenohumeral ligament, which is affected, is inflamed, and is partially torn. So the treatment depends on severity. If the changes are really mild, so mainly there's only synovitis, we can treat it with conservative treatment, exercise restriction, rehabilitation, different modalities, like as I was saying before, shockwave therapy, ultrasound, laser, and very important, the hobbles. These hobbles prevent abduction and allow the soft tissues to heal. If we see changes like fibrillation of the medial glenohumeral ligament, we can treat it arthroscopically with radiofrequency, thermal capsulography. If it's a little bit more severe, even putting some type of prosthetic ligaments or suture imbrications, etc. And when it's severe is when the angle of abduction is more than 50 and is almost a subluxation. In those cases, pretty much we treat it as if it was a shoulder luxation with bone anchors, medial transposition of the biceps. The postoperative management includes the hobbles for a period of time, depending on the severity. If it's very severe, I will put a Velpo for 2 weeks to prevent the dog from putting weight. And then, very important, a rehabilitation program and retraining so these dogs can go back to competition. This is, for example, the one of the tightrope. Infraspinatus contracture, you can see the infraspinatus in here, is usually a condition that affects hunting dogs. They may show a lameness for a couple of weeks that is acute, and it improves and become a mechanical lameness with external rotation of the forelimb, as you can see here in this dog. So usually the initial injury of the infraspinatus has progressed into contracture of the infraspinatus, and then causing this mechanical lameness that is, they usually walk with a circumduction of the leg and external rotation. So the treatment is always surgical. We do a lateral approach to the shoulder. We need to retract the deltoid muscle, and then we check the infraspinatus. And I will recommend you not only to cut the tendon, but also to remove like maybe a centimeter of the tendon, and very important to elevate the tendon from the capsule so that there's no adhesions between the tendon and the capsule. And usually the prognosis is excellent. So that's pretty easy to diagnose. You can see here with the external rotation preoperatively how it changed immediately after surgery. The leg is completely straight. These dogs can also suffer from medial coronoid disease. We are all familiar with the genetic condition, which is multifactorial. Genetics play a role. This is a typical puppy that presents to the clinic, with weight-bearing lameness, joint effusion, pain on flexion of the shoulder, eye of the elbow. Sometimes they come to the clinic when they are older. With osteoarthritis, if we take radiographs, we will see signs of osteoarthritis, like this osteophyte here, proximal to the anconial process. We can see another osteophyte, a sclerosis at the level of the coronoid. And if we did a CT examination, we could see a fragment. Although there's not always a fragment present, sometimes they can just have abnormal articular cartilage. But sporting dogs may suffer from a traumatic coronoid fracture, actually, which is called the traumatic jump down syndrome. So usually these dogs they have a repetitive concussion over the elbow due to these competitions and training that they do, especially very strong contact like the ones that we see in flyball or jumps. They develop subchondral microfractures in the area of the coronoid process, and finally we have a fragmentation. So these dogs, usually the radiographs are not helpful. They don't usually have osteoarthritis, although they may have a small amount of osteoarthritis, but minimal. So the best way to diagnose this is to do a CT, where we can see the fragment in the coronoid process, and the treatment is doing arthroscopy and remove that fragment. In general, if we have medial coronoid disease, like the genetic condition, we may discuss with the client between doing conservative treatment and surgical treatment. It depends on the age of the dog, the severity of the clinical signs, what we find in the CT. If it's a young dog with clinical signs of lameness, pain, and a fragment, I will usually go with arthroscopy. You can see here in the video an arthroscopic view of an elbow of a dog with a fragmented medial coronoid process. You can see that moving it, mobilizing the fragment with a probe. You can see the articular cartilage in the fragment with the subchondral bone that is quite avascular, it's quite white. And actually in the humeral condyle and the rest of the humerus, you can see eburnation. All this pink area is directly subchondral bone that is exposed. One of the advantages of arthroscopy is that it's a minimally invasive procedure. We may have a better visualization of all the intraarticular structures. As I was saying before, sometimes we may have a fragment, sometimes we may not have a fragment, and just the generation of the articular cartilage, I think that will be very difficult to evaluate through an arthrotomy. So arthroscopy is actually quite good to diagnose medial coronary disease. And after arthroscopy, the recovery is really fast. Very important in these dogs after surgery, or even if we just do a conservative treatment, is include these patients in physiotherapy and rehabilitation protocol, including underwater treadmill and some type of modality like laser to decrease the pain, which I think is very important in this with this condition. And then we go down to the carpus. The carpus is mainly a shock absorber. It doesn't have a lot of muscular support, so it's prone to injury. These injuries can be due to an acute trauma. I mean, they can have a fracture, they can have a luxation of the carpus. But in these cases, in these patients, it's usually due to a chronic repetitive sprain or strain. Especially carpal injuries are quite common in racing greyhounds. So they can show hyperextension, medial lateral collateral ligament injuries. They can have also inflammation of some tendons, like the flexor carpi ulnaris. They can have fractures, osteoarthritis. There are many. I just wanted to put this photo here because if you take a slow motion camera and you film these dogs running or jumping, you can see that actually the carpus is normal to have some type of hyperextension during running, or you can see in this next slide during hitting the this mat. What is not normal is to have hyperextension in normal standing. Okay. And also these dogs, if we go to the previous slide, these dogs also use their D-claws, especially during agility. They use them to grip when they are in the obstacles, like the A-frame, to prevent them from falling. So I would recommend not to D-claw this patient. So one of the injuries is carpal hyperextension, as I was saying. Can be an acute due to acute trauma or repetitive injuries. Usually these dogs are going to be lame. They are going to have inflammation and pain in the carpus, on decreased range of motion of the flexion of the carpus, and also when they are standing, they are going to show a degree of carpal hyperextension. So, for example, we can see here this dog. We can see the difference between one side and the other side. You can see that there is hyperextension in normal standing, so this will be abnormal. Very important that in these dogs you take normal radiographs and see if you can see any fractures. But on top of the normal radiographs, I would recommend you to do stress radiographs to first confirm this hyperextension injury and also to know which joint is affected, because it may change how you treat these patients. If the antebrachiocarpal joint is intact or is not affected, you may be able to do partial carpal arthrodesis. But if the antebrachiocarpal joint is affected, you may need to do a pancarpal arthrodesis. If this sprain of the ligament is mild or moderate, then we may treat these patients with external support, with some orthotics for a few weeks and rehabilitation. But if they show pain and lameness and pretty obvious hyperextension, usually they require surgery with an arthrodesis. Other injuries that they may have in the carpus, metacarpal area, is especially in greyhounds, racing greyhounds, they can have accessory carpal bone fractures. As you can see here in this schematic, there are different types depending on where the fracture is. Type 1 if the fracture is there, type 2 if the fracture is more proximal, type 3, type 4, and then the type 5 is a comminuted fracture of the accessory carpal bone, usually by hyperextension during running. They can also have fractures of the fourth carpal bone. Usually this is a dorsal or a dorsal fracture of this bone, a slab, that can be treated with a lag screw. And they also show metacarpal fractures, especially because greyhounds, they run anti-clockwise. Usually the fifth digit of the left forelimb and the second digit of the right forelimb are the ones that are more loaded. This is related to the way they run. So those are usually the metacarpal bones that get fractured. So the fifth one of the left and the second one of the right. They can also have foot injuries like nail problems, ruptures of the nails, and very important in racing greyhounds are corns. Corns may be due to a papilloma virus. They can be due to foreign bodies in the pad of the digits, or it can be due to abnormal mechanics. If they have any abnormal footing, they can develop these corns. Here you can see a dog that actually did surgery last week. We can see the corn in this digit. It's kind of like a round area. So these are treated with surgery, and you need to be relatively aggressive. You need to do an elliptical incision to remove the whole corn, and you need to go quite deep. This white area that you can see is actually the flexor tendon, so you need to get to the flexor tendon without damaging the flexor tendon, and you need to try to remove the whole stock of the corn. Unfortunately, well, the majority of dogs improve with surgical removal of the corn, but unfortunately, in 50% of cases, they recur after 1 year. So in some cases, if they recur, you may need to do an amputation of the digit. They can also have other injuries like splitting of the webbing between the fingers, or sunburn, which is lesions in the under part of the digits in the skin. And then they can have also sprung or dislocated toes. And I just wanted to mention that sometimes they can have problems with the deep and superficial digital flexors, and they may show knocked up toes. So when they tear the deep digital flexor, which is this one here, if you follow it, that inserts in here, if this is torn, the nail kind of like goes up and they have a knocked up toe. If they damage the superficial tendon, which is this one here, and then it goes deep, they can have more like a drop toe or flattened toe. I have a photo, I don't know if you can see it very well. This toe looks longer, and it's because it's flat on the floor. So these were the forelimb injuries, and then if we go to hind limb injuries, they can also have mainly tendinopathies in the hind limbs. One is the iliopsoas strain. So the iliopsoas muscle is the fusion of the psoas major and the iliacus. So it comes from the transverse processes of L2, L3, and then the body of L4, L7. So this is the psoas major. And it fuses with the iliacus, and it inserts in the lesser trochanter of the femur. It's an important flexor of the hip, and it causes external rotation of the limb. So if you do the opposite maneuver, it will be painful. And usually, again, these are dogs that these muscles become injured during eccentric contraction while the tendon is lengthened. It can be one thing that we need to have in mind is that this iliopsoas strain may be primary, so that might be the primary problem of the dog, but it can also be secondary to other conditions. Like, I've seen dogs with iliopsoas injuries when they have hip dysplasia or even lumbosacral disease. Those conditions are painful when the dog extend the hips, so they tend to walk. They don't extend the hind limbs that much, and that causes the iliopsoas to shorten. And obviously, that will be painful if you try to extend it. So that will be secondary to the hip dysplasia, for example, or lumbosacral disease. Iliopsoas sometimes is difficult to diagnose, as I said, because it can be primary or secondary. Sometimes the lameness is subtle, sometimes it's a more significant lameness, and usually what they have is a shorter stride. So what they don't want is to extend the hip, because obviously that extending the tendon, the iliopsoas tendon, and that's painful. And in working dogs, we may see this as a decreased performance. So if we do an orthopedic examination and we apply pressure directly over the iliopsoas, or if we do extension of the hips with internal rotation of the leg, that will cause pain. So if we see this video here, this is a dog that I saw a couple of weeks ago. The dog, I'm palpating the iliopsoas, and the dog is quite painful. I'm not applying that much pressure. He's resistant. He's not allowing me to extend the hip because it's quite painful. So I'm trying to be gentle, but he's quite painful. So I cannot even extend the hymen. It's very, very painful. And if you apply a pressure of the iliopsoas, it's quite painful. So the diagnosis, obviously, our clinical examination is going to be very important. Then we can take radiographs. In the radiograph, sometimes you may see mineralization at the level of the insertion or even avulsions, but the majority of times you are not going to see anything. I usually do CT examination because that way I can evaluate the lumbosacral space and also, obviously, the hips. These three conditions sometimes are difficult to differentiate initially clinically because they the gait is very similar. So I usually do a CT, including the lumbosacral area. You can do also an MRI, but the iliopsoas is a quite long muscle, so it takes a long time to do an MRI. So I usually do the CT with the ultrasound. And it can be, because you need to apply the probe with a little bit of pressure, the majority of times we need to sedate the dog because it's quite painful to apply the probe and do the ultrasound of the iliopsoas. In the iliopsoas, you may find enlargement of the tendon or even hypoechoic foci in the tendon. So the treatment depends on the chronicity and if there are other pathologies like lumbosacral disease or hip dysplasia. When they have an injury in this muscle, they change the gait. So it's going to be very, very important to treat and change the abnormal posture that they have. So for acute lesions, so treatment is in general a conservative management for iliopsoas strain. So for acute injuries, I usually start with NSAIDs and muscle relaxants. It's a very painful muscle, so in some occasions I've given metoclopramide to relax the muscle. And then I apply cryotherapy, exercise restriction, very important. So anything that stretches the tendon we need to avoid. And then start the patients in a rehabilitation program. I usually start with laser therapy to relax the muscle and allow healing and increase vascularization of the muscle. Passive range of motion activity in a normal, non-painful range of motion. We don't want to do any stretching because we are causing micro fissures of the or micro tears of the tendon, and we don't want that. And very important along the whole rehabilitation process is to work on core strengthening of this patient. So sometimes these muscle injuries happen because the iliopsoas is taking over quite a lot of these forces. So we are trying to strengthen the core muscles so they take over and they allow the iliopsoas to relax and not work so hard. So very important core strengthening exercises. If it's a chronic lesion, it's painful, but it's not as painful. So usually I don't give any muscle relaxant. The recovery is longer than in acute process. So the longer the condition has been there, the longer the recovery is. And I usually start with therapeutic ultrasound or laser with massage, work on posture. As I was saying, usually the gait is abnormal, so we need to work on that. Very important, as I was saying, work on the core strengthening of the core muscles. In chronic conditions, if the stretching is not that painful, we can just do stretching. And well, with time, actually, during the rehabilitation protocol. So I will start initially not stretching the muscle and then progressing to stretching and underwater treadmill, but no swimming. Swimming causes quite a lot of jerky movements and stretching of the tendon, so we are trying to avoid that. It's been reported that regenerative medicine can be used in iliopsoas muscle, and it's been reported a couple of cases with contracture, proper contracture of the iliopsoas muscle, and in those cases you need to do surgery because the structure of the muscle is completely different, it's completely fibrosed. There's no normal muscle tissue, it's just fibrous tissue. So in those cases there is a proper contracture and you need to do surgery. Another tendon injury that we may see in these especially working dogs is gracilis contracture. This is the gracilis muscle that inserts in the proximal tibia in the medial aspect, and there's also a little bit of the gracilis that go to the calcaneus. So usually an injury to the gracilis may be associated with an acute or chronic trauma, although it's been associated also with autoimmune disease, drugs, infection, neurogenic vascular. It's most commonly present in German Shepherds, adult dogs. They may have an initial muscle injury. They may be lame after a trauma, for example, after falling over. And then that lameness improves, but then it evolves into a gait abnormality. If you look at this video, you can make it bigger in your screen. This is a German Shepherd, a police dog, and you can see it's bilaterally affected, but the right side is more affected. There is internal rotation of the paw with external rotation of the hock. It's kind of like a jerky movement. I usually say it looks similar like a Michael Jackson kick. So this is pathognomonic for gracilis contracture. Okay, if you see this, this is our gracilis contracture. In this dog, the left is slightly affected, but is more obvious on the right. Usually, our physical examination, we can see a very taut and firm band in the medial aspect of the leg. It's kind of like a cord. Is the contracture gracilis. There's no muscle there anymore. It's just a fibrous tissue. And usually, if you try to do extension of the stifle, you cannot extend because it's prevented from the contracting or contracted gracilis, and it may be also be painful. If you take radiographs are usually normal. Is usually diagnosed with MRI or ultrasound. In those cases, you can see these hyperechoic fibrous tissues, like a fibrotic band in the medial aspect of the leg. Treatment, as I was saying, is more like a chronic. When they develop this abnormal gait, is usually chronic. In the past, we tend to do surgery and we removed the whole gracilis, but it has been shown that usually even if you remove the whole gracilis, the lameness recurs a few weeks postoperatively, because usually then other muscles become contracted, like the semimembranosus and semitendinosus, so we don't do surgery anymore. The treatment is aggressive rehabilitation. Here you can see this dog, this German Shepherd. We are treating it with therapeutic ultrasound, which is trying to relax the muscle, increase the healing of the tendon, and we work quite aggressively with passive range of motion massage, underwater treadmill, and usually these patients, they require a maintenance to keep the range of motion of the leg adequate. I mean, they are not going to become normal, but at least we are trying to make them less affected so that they can return to duties. So the earlier you do the diagnosis and the treatment, the better results. Obviously, these patients working and competition dogs, they may also suffer problems in the hips, like hip dysplasia. As you can see here, we can diagnose these patients when they are puppies, and we will see laxity in the hip, or we may be able to diagnose them later in life with osteoarthritis, as you can see here. The majority of dogs respond well to conservative treatment, but obviously we are talking about competition dogs, so sometimes conservative treatment is not enough and they may require total hip replacement so that they can go back to competition, hopefully, if there's no complication, or you can treat them conservatively and just decrease the level of competition. These dogs can also suffer from medial patellar luxation. The treatment depends on the grade of the patellar luxation. I'm not going to go into much detail, otherwise it's just we don't have time in 1 hour. But the medial patellar luxation, you remember the grading of the medial patellar luxation from 1 through 4. Usually a grade 1, I will treat it conservatively. You can do rehabilitation and electric stimulation of the quadriceps to try to keep the patella in place. If it's a grade 2 or grade 3 and the dog is clinical, then I would do surgery. And then obviously grade 4, the prognosis is a little bit more guarded because they may require more more surgeries. And then cranial cruciate ligament disease is another common condition in working and sporting dogs. And in general, you know that there are many techniques that have been reported as a treatment for cranial cruciate ligament disease. Usually in sporting dogs, I tend to recommend osteotomy techniques like a TPLO, a TTA, a closing wedge, because usually the return to function is quite quick. If we see the video, I think it's in the next slide. This is a German Shepherd the day after an osteotomy procedure, and you can see that the dog is weight bearing is lame. He's not putting 100% of the weight. He just had surgery the day before, but you can see the day after surgery they are putting weight on the leg. So the recovery is quite is much faster than with a lateral suture, and I think is more adequate for these competition dogs. Other injuries that they may have is injuries to the common calcanean tendon. You know that the common calcanean tendon is formed by the gastrocnemius, and then they have a band from the biceps femoris and the semitendinosus, semimembranosus, and the gracilis. They have some insertion in the calcaneus bone, but then part of the, or the superficial part of the calcanean tendon goes to the digits. So they may come with a complete rupture, as you can see here in the third photo. If you have a complete rupture of all the deep and superficial components, they are going to come with a complete plantigradism, and you frequently can feel a gap in that area, but they can also come with a partial rupture, and usually the one that remains intact is the superficial digital flexor. And because there's no complete plantigradism, there's partial plantigradism, and because this tendon needs to it has a longer path, that causes the flexion of the toes. So if we see here some photos, so this is what you will see, a dog with a complete rupture. If you extend the stifle, usually you shouldn't be able to flex completely the hock, but in these cases you can completely flex the hock. If you have a partial rupture, this is the normal leg. And this is, I don't know if you can see very well because it's a black dog, but it's a partial rupture. So there is some degree of hyperflexion of the hock. But then I don't know if you see the difference between these toes and these ones. There is the toes are completely flexed. You can do diagnostic imaging. I would start with radiographs to see if there is an avulsion fracture or there was any type of mineralization of the tendon. That will be consistent with more like a degenerative process of the tendon. You can do also ultrasound. Here in this dog, I did an ultrasound. That's why it's clipped. You can see changes in the fiber pattern, in the collagen fiber pattern. You can see also the gap in the tendon. So usually if you have a complete rupture, a partial rupture that leads to hyperflexion and plantigradism, treatment is surgical. You need to approach the area, debride the edges carefully and reattach it with some tendon suture techniques like the three-loop pulley or the locking loop here. Very important that the edges of the tendon are in contact. If it's if there's no tendon to tendon and you need to reattach the tendon to the bone, you may need to do some bone tunnels in the calcaneus to reattach the tendon to the calcaneus, and then you need to support it externally either with a cast, with external fixator, or with orthotics. I usually put an external fixator with a hook in extension to prevent flexion and disruption of my sutures. If the injury of the tendon is mild, so it's mainly more like a degenerative process that is painful, that is no rupture, you can treat it conservatively with immobilization with an orthotics that you can, custom made, and physiotherapy and rehabilitation, including regenerative medicine in the tendon, especially if you have core lesions or areas of hypoechoic foci in the tendon that you can see with the ultrasound. Then in the tarsus we may have fractures, most commonly in racing greyhounds. They can have fractures of the central tarsal bone, especially on the right. It's due to, as I was saying before, they usually run anti-clockwise, so the right tarsus is supporting quite a lot of forces, and they may fracture the central tarsal bone. And the treatment is, if it's a reconstructable fracture, is treatment with screws. They can also fracture the calcaneus, they can fracture the metatarsal bone, similarly to what we saw in the forelimb. And usually, as I was saying, this is more frequent in racing greyhounds due to overuse. And then I wanted to include the lumbosacral disease, which is actually quite common in these competition dogs. You all know that the conus medullaris finishes around L6, and then we have the coda equina with all the nerves going to the femoral nerve, the sciatic nerve, the obturator. So usually this lumbosacral disease is multifactorial. So any of the structures that surround the coda equina could cause lumbosacral disease. I mean, we may have a protrusion or extrusion of the intervertebral disc. We can have lumbosacral instability. We can have abnormalities in the anatomy. We can have proliferation of the soft tissues, like the dorsal longitudinal ligament or even the joint capsule in the facets. We can have vascular compromise. So anything causing enlargement can press and compress the coda equina. We can also have like stenosis of the foramina, where the nerves are coming out, causing disease. So the clinical signs, as I was saying before, usually those with hip dysplasia, iliopsoas strain, and lumbosacral disease will have a gait that is very similar. If you see this dog, this is a dog that is showing this swinging with the hind legs. It's not lifting the hind legs very much. They are pretty much very close to the floor. The stride is shorter. They don't wanna. This dog doesn't wanna. I don't know if you can see now from the lateral, that doesn't want to extend the hips very well, but mainly is not lifting, see, is not lifting the hind limbs very much from the floor. So it's very important in dogs with these clinical signs, it's very important to differentiate between an orthopedic condition like hip dysplasia or an iliopsoas strain versus a neurological problem like lumbosacral disease or even degenerative myelopathy, which happens in German Shepherds and may look similar. So very important that, well, our orthopedic and neurological examination are going to be essential. So dogs with lumbosacral disease are going to be painful when we press over the lumbosacral area. They may show proprioception deficits. And then we will follow this with diagnostic imaging. We can do simple radiography. We suspect that the dog has hip dysplasia, but I would recommend advanced imaging for the diagnosis of lumbosacral disease. I usually start with a CT. I think in a CT you can see pretty well if there are changes in the lumbosacral area, if there is signs of degenerative processes in that area, if there's a stenosis of the foramina. Even you can see if there is soft tissue protrusion in the canal or even mineralization of the intervertebral disc. If there is a protrusion, obviously you can also do an MRI, which will give more information. Using objective evaluation techniques like the force plate and pressure mat can give you information that the dog is putting less weight on the hind limbs. So the treatment depends on the clinical signs and the severity. If the dog doesn't show neurological deficits, for example, and the only clinical sign is pain, we've had a lot of success with conservative treatment with injection of steroids in the epidural space. There's actually a paper where they saw 80%, pretty much 80% improvement in the clinical signs and 50% resolution of the clinical signs of dogs with pain in the lumbosacral area. Obviously, these dogs didn't have neurological deficits. If the dog has neurological deficits or very severe pain, in those dogs we will consider doing surgical decompression. But I think the majority come with milder clinical signs that we usually treat with a steroid injection. And then just for the last few minutes, I would like to just mention a little bit about the rehabilitation therapies that we have in our hands for these patients. I have mentioned some of them, like physical therapies, cryotherapy, we have heating to relax the muscles, we can do massages, effleurage, petrissage, friction massages to relax the muscles, to also therapeutic exercises, passive range of motion exercises, stretches, and more active exercises like cavaletti poles to try to increase range of motion. We have other exercises like going up the hill or downhill, depending on which muscles we want to work. Strengthening exercises, like giving the pod, try to strengthen the forelimb muscles. Obviously, all these therapies, they require frequent evaluations of these patients to evaluate their progress, see if they are painful, and progress with these therapies. I wouldn't start with a strengthening exercise from the beginning. Initially, I would start usually with cold packing if it's an acute process, and massage, and then we will progress to passive range of motion, stretching, and then other exercises. Hydrotherapy is another modality that, depending on the condition, we may recommend. I prefer to do, as you can see here in this video, underwater treadmill. Is a more controlled therapy than swimming. Swimming, as I was saying before, the movements are very kind of like jerky, very strong, and in some conditions that's actually contraindicated. So underwater, I think, is more controlled. You can control also the level of resistance, the speed, so it's quite very good therapy. Other therapies that I've mentioned are, for example, laser therapy. The ones that we use are either class 3B or class 4, depending on the power. They have a few biological effects. Mainly, they increase the ATP production from the mitochondria, oxygen production also. In general, they increase the metabolism of the cells, they increase angiogenesis, blood flow to the tissues, they decrease pain, they help with the healing of the tissues. So the laser has multiple applications, not only musculoskeletal injuries, but also we use it quite frequently for the treatment of osteoarthritis because it decreases pain. We also use it for the management of wounds because it encourages healing of wounds. Therapeutic ultrasound, also another therapy that we use, especially for tendinopathies. Also similar biological effects, especially, you know, relaxing muscles, increasing the healing, and allowing a faster reorganization of the collagen fibers. We have two probes, depending on the depth that we want to apply the ultrasound to. And as I was saying, we usually use it for muscle and tendon pathology. Other therapies is extracorporeal shockwave therapy, as I was saying before, especially to stimulate healing of bones and soft tissue. It also helps elimination of mineralization foci in the tendons. So mainly, well, I don't have experience myself with extracorporeal shockwave therapy, but it's been reported, as I was saying before, in shoulder conditions for muscle and tendon pathology. It can be used also for non-healing fractures and non-unions, etc. And then acupuncture also, mainly for pain in dogs with osteoarthritis. It decreases chronic pain and it also releases endorphins. And then we need to have in mind that these are not just pets. We want these dogs to go back to competition. So we need to include a retraining process so that they move from just functional to being competitive. So we need to work on the strength of the muscles, of the limbs that have been affected or that have had surgery, endurance of the dog. We need to get them to the fitness level that they had before the injury. We need to work on balance and proprioception. So it's very important that these dogs see routinely certified physiotherapies so that they can prepare and they recover. And obviously, if they have a special skill, we need to start training again for the skill, for example, the smell, like tracking dogs, etc. And then I wanted to mention just very briefly regenerative medicine, which is a growing growing therapy. We still need quite a lot of research in regenerative medicine, but in general, this therapy includes these innovative medical therapies that will enable the body to repair, replace, restore, and regenerative damage or diseased tissue. So in general, regenerative medicine does not rely on a single pathway of action. So it's a combination of actions, especially immune modulation, especially in the joints when we use it for osteoarthritis. It secretes cytokines and growth factors that stimulate healing of the tissues. It may promote cellular differentiation into the different cell lines. And in regenerative medicine, we have stem cell therapy and platelet-rich plasma. Stem cell therapy, we mainly use mesenchymal stem cells, either from the bone marrow or the adipose tissue. The adipose tissue is easier to retrieve, and actually the number of stem cells that you can get is higher than from the bone marrow. They can differentiate, as you can see here, in different cells, depending on where we use it. Obviously, here we are going to use it for the differentiation into muscle or cartilage. And so we usually harvest abdominal fat or inguinal fat, and then we obtain the stem cells, and then we've seen benefits in injuries in tendon and in osteoarthritis, especially in horses. We need more studies in dogs. Platelet-rich plasma is the part of the blood that is rich in platelets, which is like on top of the buffy coat mainly. So the platelets are, they have these alpha granules, which are really rich in growth factors. So if we inject the part of the blood that is rich in platelets, we are injecting mainly these growth factors. These growth factors, they can promote healing of the tissues directly, but they also may recruit stem cells. They produce immune modulation. We've seen benefits in patients with tendinopathies and osteoarthritis, I've mentioned it before, especially when we combine the platelet-rich plasma with stem cells. And the problem is that we need more research, and the problem is that there are many systems to obtain platelet-rich plasma. We don't know the best concentration of platelet. Is it 2 times blood? Is it 3 times, 4 times? Do we need to have low white blood cells, high blood white blood cells? They play a role in inflammation, but they may also play a role in regeneration. So there's still a lot of unknowns, so we need more research into regenerative medicine. And we have different systems to obtain platelet-rich plasma. We can use it, we can obtain it through a centrifuge of the blood, or through gravitational systems like this one, which looks like, you know, blood donation bags. And through a filtration here, we concentrate the platelets, and this is what we obtain. It's quite rich in red blood cells, unfortunately, but it's been reported to be beneficial in dogs with osteoarthritis. So so that was all that I wanted to mention today. Unfortunately, 1 hour is not enough to go into a lot of detail in all of the pathologies and all the conditions that we may see in these dogs. But I hope the presentation was useful. Here you have some recommended readings if you want. There are a couple of books about rehabilitation and canine sports medicine, different papers about supraspinatus tendinopathy, iliopsoas muscle. And if you have any questions now, I will be happy to answer. So there's one question here. Someone is asking which dose of prednisolone I use for the injection in the epidural space. So I use 1 milligram per kilo. In the paper that I mentioned, they usually give the injection, so they give it on day one. They give another epidural injection 2 weeks later, and then a third one 6 weeks later. And that's when they saw this 80% improvement. Personally, we've done a few dogs with lumbosacral pain, and I usually just inject one dose and just see how long the effect lasts. And then when the owner starts seeing signs again of pain or worsening of the clinical signs, then I do another injection. But it's 1 milligram per kilo of methylprednisolone. Any more questions? Someone else asks, so surgery for the supraspinatus tendinopathy, so how do you do exactly, how do you know how much you remove? Yeah, that's a very good question. So mainly what I do is, as I was saying before, I do some longitudinal incisions over the tendon, so I can, if there's mineralization, if it's a mineralized supraspinatus tendinopathy, with those longitudinal incisions I try to remove the mineralized foci, the mineralized tissue. If there's no mineralization, if it's non-mineralized supraspinatus tendinopathy, I still do these longitudinal incisions because it restarts the inflammatory process and it stimulates, you know, bleeding and the healing process. And then I go a little bit more medial, and the area with the supraspinatus is in touch or in contact with the biceps. If you remember the ultrasound that I mentioned, when the supraspinatus is affected, it's usually enlarged and it may impinge the biceps. So I usually cut a piece of that supraspinatus tendon that I can see that is touching the biceps. It's quite difficult to say if I remove how much, but maybe one third of that part of the supraspinatus. And I also cut the transverse humeral ligament, which holds the biceps into the groove. So that way, the biceps is a little bit more movable and is less likely to be impinged. So that's what I do. As I was saying before, I have more experience with the surgical treatment of supraspinatus tendinopathy than with regenerative medicine. But apparently now, the tendency is to treat it more with rehabilitation and regenerative medicine. Are there any more questions? Okay, it doesn't look like there's any more questions. So thank you very much for coming to this webinar. I hope you enjoyed it and you found it useful. So thank you again and have a nice day.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Peeler for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.